This is Mumia Abu-Jamal, and you're listening to the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. Enjoy!
It's the Ralph Nader Radio Hour!
Stand up, you've been sitting way too long.
Welcome to the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. My name is Steve Scrovan, along with my co-host David Feldman. Hello, David.
Good morning.
And the man of the hour, Ralph Nader.
Hello, everybody. Today we have the controversial case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, what it says about our criminal justice system, what it says about how he used his life for over 40 years in jail to constructively communicate week by week to people all over the world.
Yes, today we pay tribute to Mumia Abu-Jamal as he approaches his 70th birthday. 42 of those years have been spent in a Pennsylvania state prison, 29 and a half of those in solitary confinement on death row. Abu-Jamal was a journalist and one of the founding members of the Philadelphia Black Panther Party. As a journalist throughout the 1970s, Abu-Jamal had been extremely critical of infamous Mayor Frank Rizzo and the Philadelphia Police Department. On a fateful evening in late 1981, Abu-Jamal was found at the scene of a shooting in downtown Philadelphia. Despite a plethora of conflicting and recanted testimony, dubious assertions of a confession, racial bias, and shaky forensic evidence, Abu-Jamal was convicted of the killing of a police officer and sentenced to death. That death sentence was overturned 30 years later when a judge determined that there were too many inconsistencies in the original sentencing process. He remains a prisoner for life without the possibility of parole, yet has maintained his innocence and his journalistic career behind bars, penning numerous books, including Live from Death Row, Death Blossoms, Reflections from a Prisoner of Conscience, and Classroom in the Cell, Conversations on Black Life in America, while also doing regular commentary on prison radio. Due to the conditions of his incarceration, we will not be able to speak to Mumia directly, although we did record some questions for him, for which he was able to record some answers for us through the efforts of one of his most steadfast supporters, our first guest, Noel Hanrahan. We will speak to Noel about Mumia's life, as well as hearing from Professor Joy James, who will help put Mumia's incarceration in the broader context of our criminal justice system. As always, somewhere along the line, we'll check in with our relentless corporate crime reporter, Russell Mokyber. But first, let's lay out the whole story with our first guest. David?
Noel Hanrahan is the founder and legal director of Prison Radio, a multimedia production studio that brings the voices of incarcerated people into the public debate. Since 1992, she has produced over 3,500 multimedia recordings from over 100 prison radio correspondents, including the critically acclaimed work of Mumia Abu-Jamal. Welcome to the Ralph Nader Radio Hour, Noel Hanrahan.
Really glad to be with you.
Yeah, welcome indeed. I want to preface the program with a framework here. I never was inclined to call our system a criminal justice system. It's a criminal injustice system because it reflects race and class bias to an extraordinary degree. The studies have been overwhelming on this. You don't see many corporate criminals in jail these days. You don't see many prosecutions. You don't see many investigations of the corporate crime wave that takes a far greater toll in lives, injuries, and property than street crime does. But then the system reflects the power structure. The second thing I'd like to say is the Innocent Project, which has proved itself again and again and has been worked through many law school clinics, has shown again and again that prisoners, most of them of color, have been convicted wrongfully under the most one-sided, biased procedures and distortions of the facts of the case. And these prisoners have been released through the efforts of the Innocence Project, which is no small factor when you consider some of them have been in for 10, 20, 30 years. Some of them were on death row, which is another hands-on critique of the system. A third one is the defense counsel are not usually alert to levels of procedural defense that they are entrusted with. First of all, a lot of them are greatly overburdened. The pay for public defenders is very, very low. Last time I checked in Florida, it was under $50,000 a year. And secondly, more than a few times, the defense counsel is not competent. There was a case in the South, listeners, where there was a motion for a new trial because the defense counsel kept falling asleep during the trial. And the judge turned down the motion for a new trial, saying there's no constitutional right to the accused to have a counsel who's awake during the trial. So if you're not already aware, law schools have paid some attention to this in some of their clinics, but by and large, the first-year course in criminal law is over after a half a year, and most of the law students head for corporate practice and never look back. So with that, let's get to the case of Mumia Abu-Jamal, which has received world attention for many years. Desmond Tutu, Bishop Tutu, and Nelson Mandela, among many people around the world who have asked for a new trial because of the severe bias, which we'll hear about shortly, procedurally and substantively. Noel, can you give us a summary over time of this case, which started in 1981 in Philadelphia?
In 1981, December 9th, Mumia Abu-Jamal was driving a cab on the streets of Philadelphia, and at 13th and Locust, he had just pulled over to the side of the road to let out a fare. Across an intersection, he saw a police officer beating his brother. He got out of the cab, ran across the street, and was shot. He was on the ground. Someone else likely shot the police officer. The police officer died. Mumia Abu-Jamal was arrested. He was tried within 6 months and convicted of first-degree murder. At the time of his arrest, he was a working journalist, also driving a cab, but he was working for a variety of different outlets throughout the Delaware Valley. And he was an award-winning journalist. He was the president of the National Black Journalists Association locally. He had been an anchor for WUHY, which then became WHYY. He was hired by William Bill Zimmering, the station manager of HYY, who was the founder of National Public Radio. And Bill thought he was going to be the next Ed Bradley. He is an amazing, talented journalist who was caught up on the streets of Philadelphia, imprisoned through a very distinctly unfair trial. And it was also the murder of a police officer. And when a police officer dies in Philadelphia and many other jurisdictions, the rush to conviction is vast and extreme. So the level of, it is an extra burden in order to overcome that, the rush to judgment. So Mumia was tried very quickly. He was tried by a judge, Albert Szabo, who said on the first week of the trial to a court reporter and in front of another jurist, "I'm going to help them fry the N-word." That is the kind of justice that Mumia Abu-Jamal received. He's been fighting for his case and his innocence since then. It has been 42 years. He has had very good counsel over that time, but he's facing a system in Pennsylvania and Philadelphia, which literally does not privilege the U.S. Constitution, that it's more interested in finality in the Post-Conviction Relief Act. Those are the laws that have been written in order to deny criminal defendants the opportunity to get a new hearing. So they privilege procedure over merit. And there is something that just happened pretty recently in his case. He had the chance to have an evidentiary hearing. We had a new district attorney elected, Larry Krasner, who was not as capable of shredding the Constitution as the prior district attorneys. So when he found exculpatory evidence in a box in the storage locker number 17, he turned it over to the defense. That evidence included a statement from one of the main witnesses who asked 3 weeks after the trial, who asked the prosecutor for his money. Where is his money? And so that document was buried for 41 years. It was never given to the defense. And they refused recently to hear that in court, to give an evidentiary hearing. The guy's still alive, Robert Chobert, a cab driver who said he saw Mumia shoot the officer. He's still alive. So they could have brought him in and determine whether he was credible. But the judge in the case, Lucretia Clemens, decided that they weren't going to bring him in because procedurally they didn't have to, that the recantation evidence was, the bar was so high, and that there was plenty of other evidence in the case that would have convicted Mumia. Now, that's a summation that isn't true, in fact. I mean, he's one of the key eyewitnesses. There was only two. The other one, there was also documents in these files that proved that they'd given favorable treatment to the Cynthia White, a prostitute, who was never again arrested in Philadelphia for prostitution after she was used as a primary witness in Mumia's case, literally.
The Federal Court of Appeals took him off death row. Why?
Judge William Yawn issued an opinion from the Third Circuit Court of Appeals that said that his sentence should be overturned and that his conviction should be confirmed. So what that meant is that he had to be tried again just on the sentence, life or death. When Seth Williams, the DA, got that ruling, he elected not to retry Mumia on whether he would get life or death, that part of the trial. So Mumia and Abu Jamal was given life in prison without a hearing. He was given life in prison. And that is the sentence that he's currently serving right now in SCI Mahmoud.
Tell us about the discrimination in the prosecutor's office against allowing African-Americans on juries. How'd they go about doing that? And Mumia was convicted by an all-white jury, is that correct?
It wasn't an all-white jury, but they removed Black jurors who had the same kinds of experiences, educational attainment, whether they were employed, how close they were to city employees, all of those different variables that go into picking a jury. They removed people based on their race. So there was a set of handwritten notes from the prosecutor in these boxes that the new district attorney found, Krasner, and they recorded whether each jury was Black or white with a B or a W. But in addition to that, not just the cataloging of the race, there were notes next to each person's name describing why they did or didn't want them. And they were different based on the race of the juror. So that was one of the reasons why he should have gotten relief on Batson. But he did not get relief on Batson in both this local court case that just happened recently and also in the Third Circuit. So what the prosecutors did, there is videotapes that were released by Lynn Abraham when she was running for election against another guy. These tapes that were training tapes from the department, from the very prosecutor's office who did this in Mumia's case. And they are extraordinarily, intensely racist. They say things like, and this was around the time that Mumia was convicted, the same office, the same training, we need to remove all African-American women from the jury because they don't believe in the justice system. You're not going to get a conviction. Look, this is all about getting a conviction. So it was a training tape that, and it's up online and you can pull a clip off of it. It's just shocking how the Philadelphia District Attorney's Office was only interested in railroading the defendant, not even just getting 100% conviction rate, but railroading the poor people that were in front of them. And they detailed it explicitly in this training tape. You don't want a jury that considers reasonable doubt. You want to get rid of those people. Now, if you have to have a Black on the jury, you might want to have a Southern Black older man who came up from the South, because those people are the one, they're going to get by Batson. You're going to get by the issue of whether you have a racially composition of the jury. They're going to help you get by. That's the kind of language that these guys use in Philadelphia in the 80s and 90s.
This was a time in Philadelphia, wasn't it, where Frank Rizzo was a police chief and then mayor, and he was a notorious, nationally publicized race baiter. One time he said, "People say I'm not speaking the truth. I'll take a lie detector test." He took the lie detector test and failed. And one of the New York City publications said, "He lied." That was the headline. So yeah, this was not a particularly propitious climate for due process of law and a fair trial. What was the quality of the defense counsel for Mumia?
I'm going to actually push us to say it's not just on Frank Rizzo and now the sons of Rizzo, because our 6,500 person majority white police force are the sons of Rizzo. It is also on the district attorney at the time of Mumia's conviction. That is Ed Rendell, so the kingmaker, you know, Ed Rendell. So it's not just on the extraordinary racism of, it's on the system that's created that privileges people like Ed Rendell, who we wouldn't want to, like, you know, his dimple makes us not want to, like, excoriate him for who he was, but he ran that department. So yes, there were extraordinary.
He became governor of Pennsylvania, correct?
Yes, and he was chairman of the DNC, and he was part owner of
the National Committee.
Right, and he's part owner of the Philadelphia Inquirer. His wife is a federal judge. I mean, you know, those are the kinds of systematic people that have kept Mumia's conviction in place, who are less easy targets than Frank Rizzo, but equally culpable.
Now, let's talk about Mumia. Tell us what he did with his extraordinary life in jail as a journalist, author of 6 books, archives that are so valuable that Brown University solicited them for safekeeping for the historical context of his times. Tell us about him.
So Mumia Abu-Jamal just kept reporting. Like, Mumia was a trained journalist from the Black newsrooms of Philadelphia when they were very, you know, they had a lot of diverse and amazing training programs. And Joe Davidson was his colleague, and Juan Gonzalez was his colleague, and he was trained in reporting. So Mumia Abu-Jamal never stopped reporting. He never stopped really learning and growing. So what he says about his time on death row is he invested in himself in terms of his ability to connect with people and to read and to grow. So things he's done over the course of his career, he is fluent in French, he's fluent in German, he's conversational in Spanish. He got his BA degree from Goddard College. He got his master's degree from Dominguez Hills in California. And he's all but dissertation right now, doing his dissertation on Fanon out of the University of California at Santa Cruz in their History of Consciousness program. So he's writing his dissertation. So he reached out to all of us through his radio commentaries. So he's done weekly radio commentaries, thousands of them. He's written 13 books. The latest Prison Radio published, which is called Murder Incorporated, Empire, Genocide, and Manifest Destiny. It's a send-up of the United States and its imperial and neocolonialism realities. And because he's hard-hitting, because he is in a position where he's telling the truth, his own truth, and his people's truth, he's not compromised. Like, when he was out on the street, he was offered a very high-paying job on television in 1980. And they had 2 requirements, change his name and cut his hair. And he told his sister, you know, it wasn't the biggest deal changing my name or cutting my hair, but it was the next compromise that they would have asked me to do. So I didn't take the job because I knew it was just the beginning of the compromises if I had to change my name or cut my hair. So he was like, had dreads before Bobby McFerrin. So it was like he was wearing dreads in the early 80s, pretty unusual. I'm just saying, he's an amazing guy, very resilient. Alice Walker says he's got like 99 lives. He's been able to continue under these awful, awful conditions, really repressive conditions. His conditions now are extremely bad. He's had double bypass heart surgery. He survived hepatitis C. We got him the cure. We went to court. We were able to get people all over the country in prison the cure. Like, just so your listeners know, the Liver Association said they couldn't do interferon treatments anymore, and the prison was refusing to give people the hepatitis C cure, which was bought by Gilead from Soberfure. So it's like a public health imperative that we treat hepatitis C in this country. It's like polio. You could get rid of it. But they were not giving it to people in prison, and they aren't giving it to poor people.
How old is he now?
Mumia will be 70 on April 24th of this year.
And he lost his wife of many, many years, who was a great sustaining force with her visits to the prison over the years. What was she like?
Wadia Jamal was incredibly beautiful and warm and gracious, and they spoke every day on the phone. and she visited as much as she could. And yeah, it was 41 years. It was an incredibly devastating blow to Mumia.
Was Judge Clemens' decision last year the final word about trying to release him from prison after all these decades?
Lucretia Clemens did not rule on the merits of the case at all. And the Fraternal Order of Police and the widow have gotten enough support from the Pennsylvania Supreme Court that they can conduct frivolous appeals.
We're out of time, unfortunately. We've been speaking with Noelle Hanrahan, the founder and director of Prison Radio. Ms. Hanrahan is a licensed private investigator, specializes in recording, salvaging, transfer, noise reduction, and the enhancement of audio and all media formats, as well as conducting research and interviews for civil and criminal defense investigations, a graduate of Stanford University with an MA in criminal justice from Boston University. Thank you very much, Noelle Hanrahan.
Really happy to be here.
We've been speaking with Noelle Hanrahan. We will link to her work at RalphNaderRadioHour.com. Coming up, we continue our tribute to Mumia Abdul-Jamal on his 70th birthday with Professor Joy James. But first, let's check in with our corporate crime reporter, Russell Mokyber.
From the National Press Building in Washington, D.C., this is your Corporate Crime Reporter Morning Minute for Friday, April 19, 2024. I'm Russell Mokyber. For people avoiding caffeine, decaf coffee seems like a harmless option. But some health advocacy groups argue otherwise, and they are petitioning the Food and Drug Administration to ban a key chemical involved in the decaffeination process due to cancer concerns. That's according to a report from CNN. That chemical is methylene chloride, a colorless liquid that's used in certain industrial processes, including paint stripping, pharmaceutical manufacturing, paint remover manufacturing, and metal cleaning and degreasing. Methylene chloride has long been known to be a carcinogen, said Dr. Maria Doa, Senior Director of Chemical Policy for the Environmental Defense Fund, one of five groups and individuals behind two food and color additive petitions sent to the FDA in November. For the Corporate Crime Reporter, I'm Russell Mokyber.
Thank you, Russell. Welcome back to the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. I am Steve Scrovan, along with David Feldman and Hannah and Ralph. We continue our reflections on the life of Mumia Abdul-Jamal. Before we hear from Mumia himself, our next guest is going to reflect on what his incarceration says about what Ralph calls our criminal injustice system. David?
Joy James is Ebenezer Fitch Professor of Humanities at Williams College. Professor James has published numerous articles on political theory, police, prison and slavery abolition, radicalizing feminism, diasporic anti-Black racism, and U.S. politics. She's the author and editor of several books, including The New Abolitionists, Neo-Slave Narratives and Contemporary Prison Writings, Imprisoned Intellectuals, Resisting State Violence, and Warfare in the American Homeland. Welcome to the Ralph Nader Radio Hour, Professor Joy James.
Thank you.
Welcome indeed, Professor James. You heard what Noelle Hanrahan had to say, and you're familiar with the Mumia case. We'd like you to comment on it and give it broader context, because you have studied the broader context of the criminal injustice system in our country.
Right. I mean, I appreciated the conversation that you and Noelle, you know, had together. And so much of the legal aspects came out, which were so important. But to go back to the point of Mumia's function, if that's the right word to use, or maybe it's inspiration, that someone who's been incarcerated for decades, I believe over 40 years, still has productivity that he has in terms of analyses about incarceration, racial bias, legal malfeasance in the United States. So I see Mumia as an educator, as a public educator, and the job I have is that we teach and we work with students and we develop political critiques. But what I appreciate a lot about Mumia is his compassion. He doesn't romanticize, you know, from the sight that he's endured for 40 some years. Very difficult struggles to stay centered, let alone stay alive. He's been a constant educator for me and many of my colleagues and comrades.
Well, on this point, Mumia's radio commentaries range the world. He doesn't just focus on the criminal injustice system. He has very trenchant comments on national politics, Republican Democratic parties, Congress, the empire abroad, the invasion of Iraq. He follows the news and gives very trenchant commentary. It's just remarkable how concise, precise, and professional his radio programs are under horrendous conditions, one might add, as you said. But what do you think is the impact on law schools and scholars on our so-called justice system? He has compared the treatment under our law of corporate criminals who have taken staggeringly larger lives. Just think of the opiate manufacturers, for example. Think of the chemical toxic waste corporations, for example. Think of the lead industry, which to this day imperils poor children in inner city schools with lead-based paint peeling off the walls and lead-contaminated drinking water. Think of the asbestos manufacturers. Oh, 200,000-300,000 lives lost, mostly asbestos workers in the United States. He has not neglected that. He also has commentary on conditions in other countries, how Norway treats its prisoners, and the laws in other Western countries that are much more humane, rehabilitative, instead of priest with vengeance. Do you want to give us your thoughts on his broader impact beyond his jail confinement?
Right. I mean, he's a treasure, and I don't want to make him an isolate. I think there are a number of people who have been incarcerated for decades who study and struggle. That's a phrase people use in terms of books reaching the incarcerated, but also the writings of the incarcerated coming out of prisons, right, enable us to be able to learn and study with them, if not physically in the same space, definitely with the same ethics and the same commitments. So for me, as somebody who's been teaching for decades, I welcome Mumia's interventions, but not just Mumia's. You know, I've done a number of anthologies around multiple people. I focus on people who were engaged in political dissent. You can mention people such as Leonard Peltier. You can mention formerly named H.R.A.P. Brown, but Jalil Alameen, environmental activists who've been incarcerated. So there's a way in which their work, meaning the incarcerated, whose ethics are clear, their politics are clear, there's a way in which their works can be taught in the classroom. And so that's something that I've been trying to do over the years, not just have on the syllabus an academic text. You know, God, we got the PhD and produced whatever, but to have people who've struggled with ideas, concepts, and politics. And as you pointed out, Mumia has a global view and very much focused on justice and compassion.
What's amazing is, in order to produce such cogent reports on radio, he's got to assemble a lot of facts. He has to do a lot of research. It isn't just normative assertions of this is right, this is wrong. And he's been able to do this when his health has been seriously jeopardized and suffering sporadic crackdowns by angry guards and the warden and having to go to court often just to get traditional prisoner rights restored to him. What's the scene on campus here? You've probably spoken at law schools and you teach at Williams College. Is there a growing interest in the double standard of justice in this country, which is really spectacular? These corporate criminals are now, with the advice of their brilliant corporate law firms who operate in the shadows, have achieved almost immunity from criminal prosecution. And the Justice Department under Biden have brought fewer corporate crime cases than the Justice Department did under Trump. And under Trump, they were fewer than under Obama. And they have these deferred prosecution agreements or no prosecution agreements that let these companies off. And they hardly ever go after the top executives, such as in the Boeing case and the criminal negligence, to put it mildly, that led to the crashes in Indonesia and Ethiopia. Sometimes it's much easier to focus on the criminal injustice system for minorities or for others, poor whites who don't have adequate legal representation and are railroaded into copying a plea. If you compare with the lenient treatment put it mildly, of corporate crooks who take far more lives, produce far more injuries and disease, and steal far more money than street criminals have done. Tell us, for starters, what percentage of prosecutions against indigent accused people end up in a copping a plea, and what level of coercion is operating here by prosecutors?
Yeah, so you've asked multiple big questions, so I'm gonna work on this, right? I would say I cannot directly, you know, give you a number of percentage based on the last question that you raised, but I can talk a bit, and people also could go and log in, look at the Prison Policy Org report. So they create pie charts, just like the War Resisters League does, right? They want to see where our money is going, but also in different ways, how this funding for carceral settings and systems actually harm the democracy itself and all the people in it. So going back to the Prison Policy Org, I want to just start with some of the numbers that we've got over 1.9 million people incarcerated in the United States. And I think you brought that up before. But the way in which the system works, it's very diverse. So there are thousands of federal, state, local, and tribal systems to navigate. You know, some of the quick numbers would be 1,566 state prisons, 98 federal prisons, over 3,000 local jails. Then there's 1,300 plus juvenile correctional facilities. That's a euphemism, correctional facility. The ICE, or the immigration detention facilities, and then, you know, the indigenous or the Indian country jails. So the way that I see what we're struggling against, which I believe echoes what Mumia has been writing about and talking about, is very complex overlapping systems of containment and control, in which poor and working class people are going to be the most negatively affected. And yes, race is an issue. I believe that's what you brought up both in the conversation with Noel and what we're chatting about now. I mean, when I think about 2020, and Mumia has written about all the atrocities that I see as becoming public lynchings in some ways, and oddly, you know, driving clicks or media sells, right? From before George Floyd to 2020 to going on today. So there are ways in which our funds are redirected to maintain prisons that are harmful and dysfunctional and violent themselves, that our funds are used to settle, I would call it compensation. I can't find a good word for it, but it doesn't bring back a dead family member. But these allotments, you know, for example, in New York City, where I spent a lot of time, Eric Garner's family received $5 million, but that's public money. And that's not saying the family shouldn't have received it, but there's this loop that we have to dig out of or sever from, not just massive amounts of money going into carceral systems that harm people on a regular basis, but the way in which we can't control our economies from being used for warfare, and also for what I would call domestic warfare on people in the United States. And the last thing I would say to this is, you mentioned, or maybe I was thinking about it, the Koch brothers. I know there's only one now, but their attempt to change legal rules about pollution reflected the fact that, you know, their father made their money through oil and gas industries through the Third Reich. If I recall what Jane Mayer was writing about, the way in which billionaires and the Koch brothers included in that were able to use money to create predatory systems of accumulation and then try to flip the policing apparatus to only favor the rich.
You know, listeners should realize there are pilot projects in prisons that have worked to produce more humane rehabilitative conditions and lower recidivist rates when they've served their time trying to adjust to society. And Steve McNamara, who pioneered prison newspapers in California, told us on this program a while back that his newspaper, the San Quentin Times, is run by prisoners. They have reporters, editors, photographers, and the record is that when they get out, they have a far, far lower recidivist rate, near zero, because of the experience they've had in prison journalism. And there are a lot of other examples around the country, but there doesn't seem to be a very accelerated diffusion rate the pilot projects that work and are humane and increase the safety of the society and salvage the lives of these prisoners and release the ones that have been wrongfully convicted, but they don't diffuse fast enough through the prison system. There are too many perverse incentives that counter it, and I just want to make that point in order to provide a bigger context. Steve?
Professor James, what does the establishment fear about Mumia that will not allow them to release him? What's the fear?
I would say he has had a huge impact on people around the world. So Noel mentioned that, you know, he's fluent in French. He also, I believe there's an avenue in Paris that's named after him. I don't want to make him or project that he's a charismatic person, because sometimes, you know, that could go either way, right? It's not always positive. But he has dedicated his life to supporting life, even while he was on death row and even while he's been caged for decades. So I think it's a combination of things, partly that he's Black. And so the notion that you would have an autonomous Black voice that critiques the state, capitalism and imperialism, environmental devastation on a regular basis, that is problematic. I mean, to have a Lloyd Austin, like the Black face of empire, that kind of works for, you know, state corporate media. But anybody who would be seen as being more independent, some people would say a rebel, that would be problematic. But I also think it's his history that he was in the Black Panther Party. I mean, just for a brief moment of time, and a time when Kathleen Cleaver would say most of the members were teenagers and they, you know, were very optimistic, aspirational, but there was a whole policing mechanism to destroy dissent in the United States, whether it was the war, you know, the U.S. war against the Vietnamese. So you could think Kent State or Jackson State, or the way in which COINTELPRO, the Chicago Police Department, dealt with Fred Hampton and Mark Clark in 1969. So Mumia, in a way, he has the love, but he is also fearless as an analyst, as a compassionate, quote, citizen who's locked up, and he's fearless as a writer. So I think his narratives and his lineage of struggle is what makes him very problematic to the bureaucracy and very problematic to the traditional policing mechanism.
David?
Clarence Thomas was a Black Panther, briefly. Could you tell me what solitary confinement actually means? How many years did I hear that Mumia was in solitary for 20 years? What is solitary confinement?
29 and a half years.
29 and a half years in solitary confinement? What does that mean?
Yeah, that's a great question. I pause because I can't imagine how one could maintain their emotional, intellectual, and their physical selves, like united, being isolated from talking to other people, from touching other people, even just a fist bump or a hug, at times from seeing the sky and knowing, you know, if it's day or night, what the weather is. I mean, the disconnection from Earth, from humanity, is probably one of the worst punishments, you know, short of death, that could be inflicted. And so I consider it to be torture. And I believe that President Obama at one time attempted to ban it. Somehow these improvements or these policies that are supposed to improve policing and incarceration in the United States don't seem to stabilize to the degree that they need to be stabilized to help people. In New York, I remember, because we have Rikers Island, that a number of people and argue rightly that it should be shut down. It's used against teenagers as well. So, and I consider teenagers, you know, their brains are not fully formed, so they're children. So this is a torture implement in order to break the spirit of people who don't want to conform to incredibly harsh and dehumanizing environments. And they shouldn't conform to dehumanizing environments. They should try collectively to stabilize environments so that people can have healthy lives, and people who do not need to be in a setting with so much protection because they have issues with self-regulation. I actually don't have all the words that I want to say, because maybe I have too many words, but solitary confinement is barbaric.
There is some progress here. Some states have started to ban it. People like Jim Ridgway, who pioneered advocacy against solitary confinement and was in contact with a lot of prisoners in solitary confinement, saw before he unfortunately passed away some glimmers of hope here, including equating it with torture and judicial cases, calling it unconstitutional because it's so equated in the minds of many professional psychologists who've studied this with torture. So there is some light at the end of the tunnel, it is hoped. Professor James, there is a requirement that they have to have 1 hour a day out in the yard, don't they?
There may be a requirement from what I know, which is not comprehensive, of people that I correspond with who were incarcerated, getting the guards to actually follow rules that are healthy. They don't tend to have that kind of capacity. One thing I can think of, a quick example, would be when incarcerated people go on strike. And so they're not being violent, but they're striking about the lack of clean conditions, the like having rotten food served to them, the brutality from the people who are employed to run the prisons, that the way they're treated is not always in ways that conform to the status of protecting health and life.
Yeah, a lot of prison rules are violated in practice, but the norm is that if you're confined in an incarcerated tiny room, you're supposed to be given 1 hour of exercise in the open air prison yard. Hannah?
Yeah, so in your discussion about the public support for Mumia and how he's viewed as this advocate for love, I was wondering if you could expand on that. And I've read some of your writing about him and his case and what he's come to symbolize. And I wonder if you can expand on how, you know, it's not just he's being objectified, he's becoming this symbol for people as an abstract emblem of resilience and peace, that it's actually a more deliberate choice. And he actually, part of his, you know, why he was incarcerated was the political landscape that led to his incarceration was being part of the Black Panthers, being part of this caretaking network, that it actually is sort of a radical choice to actively choose love.
Yeah, thanks, Hannah. First, I want to say I agree with Ralph that things can be functional in prisons, but I am so committed to abolition that I don't focus on what works. I focus a lot on what is the dysfunctional. In terms of Mumia, right, I think it's important that we don't make icons out of political prisoners or former political prisoners. I don't think that is productive. I think we welcome people's contributions and we appreciate them and we work to get them out to the best of our ability. So sometimes that's through writing letters, sometimes that's through hiring new attorneys and so on and so forth. But I don't consider Mumia to be a martyr in a way that becomes someone who's elevated above the masses, if that makes sense. This is my take as an African-American woman who's been organizing for a number of years with incarcerated people. I think the United States is very unclear about its history. We're already dealing with these book bans from conservatives and reactionaries, but there are also ways in which we as progressives or liberals can distort what it means to be a political detainee or someone who's incarcerated based on ethics and the organizing that they did. So I don't conflate political prisoners so much with the majority of people who are incarcerated. I understand both sectors are victimized by neglect, victimized by just being caged and everything that comes with that. But if we understand that they make contributions, but also that while we're reading them, we have to also make our own contributions, that we have to read critically, that we have to think about things as adjacent to each other. And we also have to see in what ways our politics or our organizing prove to be productive. In other ways, our politics are not productive because our organizing skills don't meet the task of dealing with the largest carceral infrastructure or bureaucracy in the world.
Well, we're out of time, unfortunately. Would have liked to talk a little bit about prosecutorial coercion of indigent accused defendants. I think the figure is over 80% are coercive plea deals where, you know, an indigent is told, you know, you can get 30 years for this, and if you agree to 8 years in jail, we can close the deal. And the indigent usually doesn't have a very time-available counsel, assuming the counsel is even capable of performing the duties. Anyhow, what's the best way for people to reach you if you'd like to give a contact, Professor James?
I would say I do different kind of conversations. I have conversations with Black Power Media. So I would suggest people look that up. They would love to interview you, Ralph Nader. And this is where communities are talking about what we've been talking about, but also, you know, focusing a lot on working class, unhoused people, and also this specificity of how the ways in which, you know, policing works, that Black and Indigenous people, poor people, undocumented people sort of are on the receiving end, the brunt of what happens in terms of carceral destabilization and violence from the state.
Well, thank you very much. We've been speaking with Professor Joy James at Williams College. She authored many books and articles, and one of them is titled Resisting State Violence. Thank you again for coming on the show.
Thank you all. Take care.
We've been speaking with Professor Joy James. We will link to her work at RalphNaderRadioHour.com. Now we end today with the man himself. We recorded some questions from Mumia, which Noel was able to take back to him and have him record some answers, which he was able to do over a phone line. So without any further ado, let's hear from Mumia.
I'd like to ask Mumia his comments on the commercialization of state and federal prisons, as well as the spread of corporate-owned prisons. I mention the former because the telephone companies, for example, have made a horrendous profit on charging prisoners to make phone calls to their family. And there are a lot of aspects of publicly owned prisons that have been commercialized.
Ralph, I remember fondly, actually, Eliot Spitzer, who was the governor of New York several years ago. When he got elected, one of the first things he did, he ordered that all phone charges be localized across New York State. So a guy calling from a prison in the far north of New York State, making a call to Brooklyn, Bronx, Harlem, it'll be a local call. So, you know, the phone company didn't like it, but, you know, this was the law. He was the governor. And, you know, no matter, like, his little problem that he had and, you know, his removal, I always thought that that was pretty cool, what he did. And I'm sure, you know, guys up in New York felt the same thing. But, you know, if you look at profiteering interests, phones are small matter. And the real issue I think we should think about is the cost of prisons in terms of the dollars that people pay through their taxes. And once they get a grip on that, you know, billions of dollars are paid in prisons. But most of that money goes to wages for rural people. You know, on the crime bill years ago, and subsidize the building of prisons across the country. I thought of that and I said, this is a white rural employment program. And I think that's just the truth of the matter. And I thought he was using it for kind of a political ploy and a political play to try to get rural people to, you know, think of Democrats in a new way. It didn't work out. When I heard and thought about it, it just made the issue of prison abolition more clear, you know. And that's the real dollars and the real profiteering, you know. The average guard makes about $60,000. But I knew a guard here at this jail. She's now retired. She made almost $100,000 a year. I mean, you know, come on. It's just crazy.
To what extent have you been able, Mumia, to connect with fellow prisoners where you are incarcerated and other prisoners, often called political prisoners, in other prisons and penitentiaries around the country?
Well, you know, I talk to them and walk with them in the yard if they want to walk fast. I sometimes teach the brothers around me. As for other brothers who are like political prisoners, other jails, it's real difficult to communicate with them because male is, you know, really censored. And, you know, guys will write to you and you won't get it. You write to them, they're not going to get that mail.
I hope this is not too obvious, but when you see and read about the trials of Donald Trump and see how the court and the legal system treats him, and in particular his plea for absolute immunity to commit crimes, a man who said he could shoot somebody on Fifth Avenue and get away with it, what do you have to say about that and how does that make you feel?
Steve, you know, I love it when I hear or read of so-called conservatives talking about, you know, two tiers of justice. If anything, there's at least three tiers. There's one tier for white people, another tier for black folks, and a third tier for the very rich. Now, guess who gets sweetest deals? I mean, look, it doesn't take a rocket scientist, right? If you're rich in this country, you can get every break that you can afford. You can get the best justice, the best lawyers, and they will fight wars.
Mumia, prisoners in America are not allowed to vote. Could you tell us how civic-minded prisoners actually are and why giving them the vote would be a net positive for both Democrats and Republicans?
David, you asked about the right of prisoners to vote. And I think all prisoners should be at least given the opportunity to vote. If you think about it, if prisoners could have voted back during the 2000 Bush-Gore election, Gore would have won, or Bush certainly would have lost, because in that state, Florida, which was very, very, very close to several hundred votes, if prisoners were able to vote, I think it would have had a different result. But there are some states, by the way, that I believe allow prisoners to vote. Idaho, Vermont, I believe. And think about South Africa. Post-apartheid, prisoners can vote in South Africa. But why, of all the 50 states, would Idaho or Vermont allow prisoners to vote? Well, if you look at who's in those states, I think that answers that question. Think about this. One of the issues and demands and protests sparking the American Revolution was taxation without representation, right? Well, guess what? When prisoners use the phone or go to the commissary, every item you buy, every call you make, is taxed. So what about taxation without representation in this so-called democracy where every voice should be heard and every person should be allowed the opportunity to vote?
Mumia, what are your thoughts on the latest developments in Gaza and specifically South Africa's genocide case at the International Court of Justice?
Francesco, that's a great name, by the way. I love the sound. Well, you asked about Gaza, and I think it's just and fair that the country formerly known as the apartheid state objects to the newer apartheid state of Israel. The late Desmond Tutu visited Israel and recognized apartheid when he saw it. I mean, you know, he had spent most of his life under apartheid. He knew it very well. He said, if the Palestinians had a little more color, if they were black people instead of, you know, light brown people, it would be very, very clear to see what was happening. So South Africa, they know something about apartheid, but they also know something about genocide, at least Southern Africa. There was a tribe called the Hereros back in the early 1904 is the exact year, I believe. It was a German colony in what was considered then Southwest Africa. It's now Namibia. Out of 85,000 Hereros, the tribe itself, when the Germans got there, they opened concentration camps, slave labor, and they eradicated a lot of these people. When they left, there was something like 15,000 people out of 85,000. You know, call it by its name. Every colonized nation has dealt with genocide when the invaders brought conquest, colonialism, or imperialism, and they're well-placed to make the charge. So, you know, I think Israel is no exception. In an op-ed article of June 24, 2019, placed in the New York Times, an Israeli diplomat, Danny Denon, the ambassador to the UN, wrote, he had two suggestions for Palestinian peace. One, they should commit national suicide, quote unquote, national suicide. And two, they should surrender. Those are the terms of peace announced by Israel in a published article in the Times.
Mumia, what were some of the most audacious, petty, ridiculous experiences of censorship in your time producing radio from prison?
Anna, I was doing a live report, a comica for Democracy Now. That was back when I was on death row. And I was in the middle of my commentary when I saw a young blonde guard run down the hallway, and he yanked the phone cord out of the socket. And immediately, the phone went dead. You know, I'm sitting there, hello, 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 because I couldn't believe it. And he just strutted away like he, you know, fought in a war and did something very heroic.
What would you urge the citizenry to be doing about the whole criminal injustice system in terms of your priorities for change?
In prison, the most important thing, the one thing that stops guys from coming back is education. The most important thing is education. I would even say what people need is a deep colonial education, especially in prison.
That's our show. I want to thank our guests again, Noel Hanrahan, Joy James, and wish a very happy 70th birthday to Mumia Abu-Jamal. For those of you listening on the radio, we're going to cut out now. For you podcast listeners, stay tuned for some bonus material we call The Wrap-Up, featuring Francesco DeSantis with, in case you haven't heard, a transcript of this program will appear on the Ralph Nader Radio Hour Substack site soon after the episode is posted.
Subscribe to us on our Ralph Nader Radio Hour YouTube channel, and for Ralph's weekly column, it's free, go to nader.org. For more from Russell Moe Kiber, go to corporatecrimereporter.com.
And remember to continue the conversation after each show. Go to the comments section at RalphNaderRadioHour.com and post a comment or question on this week's episode. We might not like them all, but we read them all.
Join us next week on the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. Thank you, Ralph.
Thank you for everybody who makes the program possible and for everybody who listens in.
Thank you for your time, folks. All the best. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
Hi, this is Jimmy Lee Wirt, and welcome to The Wrap-Up. We expand on our conversation with Noel Hanrahan, who gives us more insight into Mumia as a person and the conditions under which he lives.
His conditions are pretty bad. It's very difficult to visit, and he doesn't have a good exercise or a good diet. So we've been very much doing a campaign to change his diet and to get him exercise and to make sure his visiting list is bigger, is robust.
Do it allow you to bring food to the prison?
They do not. It used to be in the United States that was possible, but it is no longer possible for there. It's now all contracted. It's Aramark. It's how to profit and commodify a prisoner is the quote unquote ideal. So they're profiting off of every, whether it's the phone calls, whether it's the books, whether it's the, you know, they commodify people's representation. So when you're convicted of a felony in Pennsylvania, you lose your vote. You also lose your representation. So the rural county that holds the prisoner takes the congressional representation. When that prisoner is released, they keep it. So juvenile lifers who've been released back to Pennsylvania, like Salim Holbrook, the executive director of the Abolitionist Law Center, Greene County in rural Pennsylvania is still holding his representation for Congress and national seats. So they commodify every part of a prisoner.
This is a state prison, not a corporate prison. What do you mean by representation?
So the number of Congress people in Pennsylvania is done by a population census. So when the prisoner is imprisoned in the rural county of Greene County, he is counted in that census and they get more congressional representation. When he's paroled, when he's released, they keep it.
Talk about the support Mumia has gotten over the years, domestically and around the world. In 2011, after an exhaustive study, Amnesty International called for a new trial. What other support has he been getting?
I think that the world understands that the United States is an imperial power, and it's has a neocolonialism at home. And they respect people who challenge the United States construct, its capitalist formation, its racial capitalism. And so they relate to Mumia as an intellectual, and they relate to Mumia as an example. And I think his case really blew up in terms of the death penalty. So the death penalty is not used across the world the way it's used in the United States. And in fact, mass incarceration is not used anywhere on the level that it is used here. And this structural way the organization of our country is, it's used to commodify prisoners and people of color and to disable people's enfranchisement. So I believe, after much study, that, you know, it's really a program to make sure that the poor do not ask for work, bread, and humanity. And so it's taking the deindustrialized cities and managing labor. It's managing potential resistance. And they do that structurally, and they have in the past done it by any means necessary. Like, the state has really disabled liberation movements internally, you know, Malcolm, Martin, Mumia.
Let's go back to the support around the country for law schools, civil rights groups, civil liberties group. Did the Innocence Project consider taking up his case? Bring us up to date.
So, you know, it's partly because he's able to be seen as a human being, because he has a humanity that reaches people, because he has a voice, because he has images that we were able to liberate from the prison. I mean, we really did struggle to get both his voice out. They sued us to prevent him from having pencils and using the phone to record commentaries, and we fought back and won those cases. So I think it's been the fact that he can reach people. He's on 100 stations all across the country. He's written 13 books. It's because people can feel him and touch him. He's Brown University just did a gallery showing of his artwork. He's also an artist. He does watercolors, and they're beautiful. So I think he reaches people. He's always reached people. My mail person who comes to the door says, I remember him on the radio in Philly. He's magical. I mean, Mumia is magical. He's an amazingly warm, gracious guy who I think really does reach people. And then again, organizing. So when NPR hired him, when National Public Radio and All Things Considered hired him, and I pitched his commentaries to Ellen Weiss at National Public Radio, and Bob Dole got up on the Senate floor and threatened their funding if they ever dared air him, I was pissed. I was angry. I was organized. After that. So I went and got his first book published, liberated it from prison, took it to New York, got a publisher. And then I did 350,000 pieces of direct mail to make sure that Mumia Abu-Jamal's voice was heard. Because they also told me, you know, as a radio producer, I don't have a career after that, after I pitch it. And Ellen Weiss sits me down in her office and says, bring me a more acceptable prisoner. And I was like, oh, wow, I'm 26. Looks like I hit that glass ceiling. So I liberated his first book from prison. I did a direct mail campaign to really promote it. And Addison Wesley got pressure from the Fraternal Order of Police, and they dumped it. They took down all of their advertising for it because they flew a plane over Addison Wesley's headquarters in Reading, Massachusetts, and said they were going to attack their textbook division. So that was the kind of first battle to really get his voice out. And we've kept it up. I mean, we are trying to bring Mumia home. I can't work with him just as a colleague to promote his materials, but I have to honor the fact that he deserves to be free. So that's what we're trying to do. So I am 100% Irish, and I present as a little old white lady. And so I go to the Fraternal Order of Police press conferences, and I fit right in, except I don't dye my hair. And so I interviewed Maureen Faulkner, the widow of Daniel Faulkner, and she said, we are going to appeal and appeal and appeal so that he dies in prison. We know that we can't win. We think he's going to get out, but we are going to appeal. Now, I think that's the definition of a frivolous appeal, which is illegal. But the Pennsylvania Supreme Court gave Maureen Faulkner and the Fraternal Order of Police standing through an extraordinary petition called a King's Bench petition. So she sued and delayed the case for 2 years pretty recently. And she has vowed to delay the case as long as possible. So that's the kind of justice we have here in Philadelphia, where we're not ruling on the merits.
One last question. Mumia has an up-and-coming grandson. Tell us about Jamal Jr.
Mumia's family is amazing and diverse. So he has, you know, a wide range of people. And one of them is Jamal Hart Jr. And Jamal Hart Jr. is created a campaign called Love Not Fear. And fear spelled P-H-E-A-R. And it was a testimony to him wanting to stand up for his grandfather. So he is an amazing, diverse, you know, lots. I want to do, one of my dreams is to have a photo of the Philadelphia Art Museum steps, like where the Rocky statue is, really. There should be George Foreman up there, but where the Rocky statue is, and have all of Mumia's family there, because there's hundreds. Like, everybody knows somebody. It's just like, he is a very rich and diverse family. He's a really, Mumia is a lover, not a fighter, and he has a lot of loving family.
Steve?
Yeah, Noel, didn't someone at some point actually confess to the crime of shooting the police officer? And how was that handled?
I can say that there's 100 pieces of evidence, whether it's people recanting or people confessing to the crime, or that the courts have ignored, and they see everything piecemeal. The PCRA, this labyrinth of laws, looks at every single piece of evidence in isolation. Whereas I believe that the Brady standard for the U.S. Supreme Court has set would see that you would see these evidence in compilation together. But in order to knock down people's cases, they look at everything in separation. So the Robert Chobert piece of evidence where he said, "Where's my money?" right after the trial. This is Robert Chobert, who said his cab was sitting there in back of the police officer's car. Where's the first pictures on the scene, which show that his cab isn't there, that the guy wasn't even there? Robert Chobert was on probation for throwing a Molotov cocktail into school for pay. And the original court judge wouldn't let that in because it was in a crim false case, right? So this guy, he was asking for his license to be reinstated because he was driving a cab without a license. So this is the kind of witness that they have. So they look at everything in isolation. So we don't get to know that he was on probation. We don't get to know that his cab wasn't there because they didn't enter the photos into evidence. And then they don't bring him forward now to say, what was the reason you asked the prosecutor for money? Because it probably wasn't bus money or lunch money.
David?
I want to circle back to something you said earlier in the conversation. You touched on how we create congressional districts based on population. I believe you said in Pennsylvania, prisoners are counted as part of the population, but they can't vote. Could you comment on the historical through line here dating back to our Constitution, and how slaves were counted as 3/5 of a human being in order to draw up congressional maps?
It's a direct through line that the way in which mass incarceration has targeted the poor and African Americans is directly related to slavery in terms of its institutionalization in the Constitution. So I only went to law school when I was 57. I'm 60 now, and I passed the bar. And if you read the Constitution, it's littered with echoes of slavery. It's just completely defined by that. So I would say that mass incarceration is just an extension of Jim Crow laws and targeting poor and poor people of color. And literally, they commodify every single thing they can. So those rural counties that are building big prisons, they are getting more congressional representation because they have those people in there. Now, even when they get released, even when they get out, they keep the representation. It's like insane.
Is that a 14th Amendment issue? Perhaps.
I don't know. I mean, I know it's being challenged by the NAACP Legal Defense Fund and that they have some rulings in their favor, but they're still litigating it. They are still litigating the fact that rural counties are counting prisoners who don't anymore live there and or who are in prison.
Listeners should know that the U.S. has 5% of the world's population and about 25% of the prisoners in jail in the world. And a lot of these prisons are corporate-owned prisons under contract with the government. And some of these companies are on the New York Stock Exchange. So like anything else in our country, public institutions are being corporatized, as our schools are and universities.
So people should know, in Philadelphia, with, you know, Frank Rizzo, the former mayor and the former police chief, and now the Sons of Rizzo, which is the current police force, they make their money off of overtime, off of arresting poor people of color and then coming to court the next day. So when you interview Larry Krasner, the DA, he'll say, everyone knows why we don't have money in Philly, because we're paying police overtime. We have a $1 billion police budget. I'm saying $1 billion, right? And there's extraordinary overtime. So when I interviewed the legislative director of one of our city council people, I asked him, what's up with our balancing the budget? And he said, oh, we know, it's police overtime. It's a problem, but they have to pay their Jersey mortgages. They want that pay bump that they get right before they retire. So they literally arrest people they know are going to get released, or poor people who can't fight. They come to court the next day and they get time and a half, or they get double time. Now, Krasner knows it, but he can't change it. He's a DA. The city council knows it because they can't fix the potholes, but it's the Fraternal Order of Police, the pseudo union, who are keeping in place this system of extracting money from the people. You know, we should, as Ralph said in the introduction, if you're spending $1 billion on crime, you better be spending it to what's really hurting people. And the way in which policing is done is only to support this white fraternal organization that has an investment in its own. Yeah, it's a level of corruption that's surreal.
Anna?
Circling back to censorship of prison radio, one of the most audacious legal challenges that you've received for, you know, trying to get speech out of prison.
So it was the lawsuit by Governor Corbett trying to take away Mumia's pencils and his ability to use the phone to record. So saying that the First Amendment stopped at the prison walls. And so we filed suit against the Silencing Act, and we were able to win a preliminary injunction and stop it. And we succeeded. And another instance was when I went to the prison in SCI Green on death row, and I had a single sheet of paper with me. I put it up to the wall and I showed Mumia what this piece of paper said. And they threw me out of the prison and I wasn't allowed to visit for many, many, many years. And so we did all our work by phone and by print. So that was very disturbing that you couldn't share a piece of paper in a non-contact visiting room. That was amazing. That was shocking. But it's true. Like, the prisons are fiefdoms. They will do whatever they can get away with. If there aren't lawyers to challenge them, if there aren't people's families to challenge them, they will do everything in silence and in the dark.
And now here's Francesco DeSantis with In Case You Haven't Heard.
On Saturday, April 13th, Iran launched drones and missiles against military targets in Israel, retaliating for an Israeli strike that killed a top Iranian general in Damascus. To his credit, President Biden has resisted calls for retaliation for this attack, either by the United States directly or by Israel. Axios reports White House National Security Communications Advisor John Kirby told NBC's Meet the Press, quote, "We don't seek a war with Iran. We're not looking for escalation," end quote. Predictably, war hawks such as John Bolton and Senator Fetterman have criticized this prudent decision. Senator Chris Coons of Delaware, widely seen as Biden's mouthpiece in Congress, is using the opportunity to renew calls for passage of the latest bill providing billions in military aid to Israel. Earlier that same day, the New York Times editorial board went further than they ever have in condemning the ongoing genocide in Gaza, demanding conditions on the military aid the U.S. provides to Israel. While the op-ed retreads tired canards, such as Israel has a right to defend itself, and contends that the U.S. must continue to furnish Israel with military aid, it acknowledges that, quote, "the administration has tried many forms of pressure and admonition, including public statements, reported expressions of frustration, and UN Security Council resolutions. None of them so far have proved effective with Mr. Netanyahu. Military aid is the one lever Mr. Biden has been reluctant to use, but it's a significant one he has at his disposal. Perhaps the last one, to persuade Israel to open the way for urgent assistance to Gaza." Yet demonstrating a kind of journalistic schizophrenia, The Intercept reports that even as the New York Times takes a tougher line on Israel, they continue to impose an Orwellian censorship regime on their staff. According to this report, top editors at the Times have, quote, "instructed journalists covering Israel's war on Gaza to restrict the use of the terms genocide and ethnic cleansing, and to avoid using the phrase occupied territory when describing Palestinian land," according to an internal memo, end quote. Further, Quote, the memo also instructs reporters not to use the word Palestine, except in very rare cases, and to steer clear of the term refugee camps to describe areas of Gaza historically settled by displaced Palestinians expelled from other parts of Palestine during previous Israeli-Arab wars. The areas are recognized by the United Nations as refugee camps and house hundreds of thousands of registered refugees. Jacob Tukey, a USAID staffer in the American Embassy in Jerusalem, was murdered this weekend. According to the Times of Israel, quote, Tukey, an Arab resident of Jaffa, was shot by an off-duty Israeli border police officer amid an apparent traffic dispute that escalated to violence, end quote. The embassy released a statement saying, quote, to Jacob's family, we send our deepest condolences. We mourn alongside you. Jacob was a valued member of our embassy community for over two decades, end quote. No official sanction by the United States is anticipated. Yanis Varoufakis, the former Greek finance minister and head of Progressive International, has been banned in Germany following his delivery of a pro-Palestine speech. Per Jacobin, quote, Germany's interior ministry issued a Betätigungsverbot against Varoufakis, a ban on any political activity, not just from visiting Germany, but also from participation in Zoom events hosted in the country, end quote. In this speech, Varoufakis warned, quote, a proud, decent people, the people of Germany, are led down a perilous road to a heartless society by being made to associate themselves with another genocide carried out in their name with their complicity. We are here to tell German Democrats, including our former comrades of Die Linke, that they have covered themselves in shame long enough, that two wrongs do not one right make, and that allowing Israel to get away with war crimes is not going to ameliorate the legacy of Germany's crimes against the Jewish people. On April 10th, the City Council of Binghamton, New York, unanimously passed a resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza, per WNBF. The resolution, which urged the Biden administration to, quote-unquote, facilitate de-escalation in order to, quote, prevent further death and humanitarian catastrophe, end quote, also called on the administration to restore funding to UNRWA. Copies of the resolution were then sent to, quote, President Biden, Congressman Mark Molinaro, and United States Senators Charles Schumer and Kirsten Gillibrand, as well as New York Governor Kathy Hochul, State Senator Leah Webb, and State Assemblywoman Donna Lupardo, end quote. Binghamton now joins the over 100 municipalities that have passed resolutions urging a ceasefire in Gaza, including San Francisco, Atlanta, Chicago, Detroit, Minneapolis, St. Louis, and Seattle, according to The Nation. Palestine is, of course, not the only part of the world in conflict. The diplomatic crisis between Mexico and Ecuador continues to escalate. Per Yahoo News, quote, Mexico has asked the top court of the United Nations to suspend Ecuador's UN membership until the South American country issues a public apology for its raid on Mexico's embassy in Quito, recognizing its violation of the fundamental principles and norms of international law to guarantee the reparations to the moral harm inflicted upon the United Mexican States and its affected nationals, end quote. Bloomberg reports that the Organization of American States issued Ecuadorian President Noboa a mere quote-unquote slap on the wrist, but separately that President Maduro of Venezuela has suspended diplomatic relations with the country, indicating continuing discontent in the region. Finally, David Adler of Progressive International reported on April 10th that Noboa had fled Ecuador quote-unquote for personal reasons. It is unclear whether he has returned. Bloomberg reports that this week, a Volkswagen factory in Tennessee will, quote, vote on whether to become the only foreign commercial car maker unionized in the U.S., end quote. The success of this vote is critical for the United Auto Workers Union's, quote, audacious effort to grow by 150,000 people across 13 automakers, including Tesla, BMW, and Nissan, end quote. While UAW has failed to organize Southern foreign-owned auto plants, even in recent years, union officials think this time will be different. Bloomberg reports, quote, this time around, UAW has recruited hundreds of people to the plant's organizing committee. Collectively, they have relationships with over 90% of the 4,300-person staff and helped the union sign up what it says is a supermajority of the plant's employees before petitioning for a vote, end quote. Isaac Meadows, a member of the factory's organizing committee, is quoted saying, when we started this campaign, you didn't talk very openly in the plant about a union. Now, it's all we talk about. On the other end of the union spectrum, Axios reports the Teamsters PAC has donated $5,000 to the re-election campaign of Republican Missouri Senator Josh Hawley, in a continuation of the Teamsters' flirtation with the GOP. Teamsters President Sean O'Brien met personally with Donald Trump in January, with Trump claiming afterwards that he had a quote-unquote good shot at winning the union's endorsement, and that same month the union made a $45,000 donation to the RNC. That said, the Teamsters donated roughly triple that amount to the DNC last year. As Axios notes, Hawley has made a point of showing support for labor, having walked Teamster and UAW picket lines, and voting with Bernie Sanders on legislation to add sick days to rail workers' master contract. Finally, with tax season over, Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen proudly reports, quote, "The IRS is delivering." This filing season, the IRS has answered 9 out of 10 calls, with 3-minute average wait times. Prior to the Inflation Reduction Act, fewer than 2 out of 10 calls were answered, with approximately 30-minute average wait times, end quote. Yet despite this success, congressional Republicans are seeking to kneecap the IRS and use that money to arm Israel. So, enjoy it while it lasts. This has been Francesco DeSantis with In Case You Haven't Heard.
And that's a wrap. Join us next week on the Ralph Nader Radio Hour. Until next time. Stand.